Chapter 29. 4 days later, June 12th, Meg McGarry gave birth to a healthy baby at the Ford County Hospital. After work, Jake and Carla drove over for a quick visit. They took flowers and a box of chocolates, though food was not needed. The flock at the Good Shepherd Bible Church descended upon the hospital halfway through labor, and the waiting room was filling up with casseroles and cakes. After a brief visit with Meg and a glimpse of the newborn in her mother's arms, Jake and Carla were obliged to have cake and coffee with the ladies of the church. They stayed longer than they had planned, primarily because Jake was among people who liked him. The following day, Libby Provine of the Kids Advocacy Foundation arrived from Washington and brought with her an ace psychiatrist from Baylor University. Dr. Thane Sedgwick worked in the field of adolescent criminal behavior and had a resume an inch thick. Credentials aside, he grew up in rural Texas near Lufkin and spoke with a twangy drawl that would never draw attention in North Mississippi. His task was to first spend a few hours with Drew, then prepare a profile. At trial, he would be held in the bullpen until the sentencing phase and brought to the stand in the likely event Drew was found guilty and the defense was fighting for his life. According to his resume, Dr. Sedgwick had testified in 20 trials over the past 30 years, always in last-ditch efforts to keep the client off death row. Jake liked him immediately. He was jovial, even comical, laid back, and his accent was a thing of beauty. Jake marveled at the fact that somehow, while picking up 4 college degrees and spending a long career in academia, the Texas drawl had not been flattened out. With Portia tagging along, they went to the jail and met Drew in what was now his classroom. After 30 minutes of small talk, Jake, Portia, and Libby left the room, and Dr. Sedgwick set about his work. At 2 p.m., they walked across the street and entered the main courtroom. Lowell Dyer and his assistant were already there with papers strewn over the state's table. Jake introduced Libby to the other lawyers. Dyer was cordial, though he had resisted Jake's petition to allow Libby to assist him at trial. It had been a silly objection, in Jake's opinion, because Judge Noose, along with every other trial judge in the state, permitted out-of-state counsel on a one-time basis when properly associated with a local lawyer. As they chatted, Jake checked out the courtroom and was surprised at the number of spectators. One group sitting behind the prosecution was the Kofor clan and a number of friends. Jake recognized Earl Kofor from a newspaper photo Dumas Lee had run not long after the murder. Next to him was a lady who looked as though she had been crying for a year. No doubt it was the mother, Janet Kofor. Earl glared at him with pure hatred, and Jake pretended not to notice them. But he glanced again and again, because he wanted to register the faces of the Kofor boys and cousins. Judge Noose took the bench at 2:30 and motioned for everyone to keep their seats. He cleared his throat, pulled his mic closer, and announced, "We are here to discuss several motions, but first, a pleasant matter. Mr. Brigance, I believe you have an introduction." Jake stood and said, "Yes, Your Honor, Miss Libby Provine of the Kids Advocacy Foundation will be joining the defense efforts. She's licensed to D.C., Virginia, and Maryland." Libby stood with a smile and nodded at His Honor, who said, "Welcome to the fray, Miss Provine. I've reviewed your application and resume, and I'm satisfied that you are more than qualified to sit in the second chair."
"Thank you, Your Honor."
She sat down, and Noose picked up some papers. "Let's get right into the defense's motion for a change of venue. Mr. Brigance?" Jake moved to the podium and addressed the judge. "Yes, Your Honor, in our motion I included affidavits from several people, all of the opinion that it will be difficult, if not impossible, to find 12 people in this county who are impartial. 4 are local lawyers, all well known to the court. 1 is the former mayor of the town of Caraway. 1 is the minister of the Methodist Church here in town. 1 is a retired school superintendent down in Lake Village. 1 is a farmer in the Box Hill community. The other is a community organizer. "I've read the affidavits," Noose said rather curtly. Of the non-lawyers, all were former clients Jake had leaned on heavily, and all agreed to the affidavits with the stipulation that they would not have to appear in court. Many of the people Jake had approached had flatly refused to get involved, and he couldn't blame them. There was a great reluctance to do anything that might be perceived as helping the defense. The affidavits all read the same. The witnesses had lived in the county a long time, knew a lot of people, knew a lot about the case, had discussed it with family and friends, most of whom had already formed opinions and doubted that a fair, impartial, and uninformed jury could be found in Ford County. "Do you plan to call these people to the stand today?" Noose asked.
"No, sir. Their affidavits are straightforward and state everything they might say in court."
"I've also read your rather lengthy brief. Anything to add to it?"
"No, sir. It's all there."
Noose, like Judge Attlee, detested wasting time with lawyers who felt the need to repeat during arguments everything they had submitted in writing. Jake knew better than to cover the same territory. The brief was a 30-page masterpiece Portia had worked on for weeks. In it, she traced the history of venue changes not only in Mississippi, but also in more progressive states. Moving a case rarely happened, and she argued that it wasn't done enough, resulting in trials that were not fair. However, the state Supreme Court almost never second-guessed trial judges. Lowell Dyer felt otherwise. In response to Jake's motion, he had submitted his own stack of affidavits, 18 in all, and they included a veritable roll call of hardcore law and order types whose tone was more in favor of a guilty verdict than an impartial jury. His 6-page brief stuck to precedence and included nothing creative. The law was on his side, and he made it plain.
"Do you plan to call any witnesses, Mr. Dyer?"
Noose asked.
"Only if the defense does." "It's not necessary. I'll take the matter under advisement and issue a ruling in the near future. Let's move on to the next motion, Mr. Brigance."
Dyer took his seat as Jake returned to the podium.
"Your Honor, we have moved to dismiss the capital murder indictment on the grounds that it violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Until 2 years ago, this indictment would not be possible because Stuart Cofer was not killed in the line of duty. As you know, in 1988, our esteemed legislature, in a misguided effort to get even tougher on crime and to expedite more executions, passed the Death Penalty Enhancement Act. Until then, the murder of a law enforcement officer was a capital offense only if he or she was on duty. 36 states have the death penalty, and in 34 of them, the officer must be on duty to allow such a charge. Mississippi, in an effort to imitate Texas and increase executions, decided to broaden the scope of death penalty crimes. Not only is murder required, but murder plus something. Murder plus rape, or robbery, or kidnapping, murder of a child, murder for hire. And now, under this new and misguided statute, murder of an officer off duty. An officer not on duty has the same standing as every other citizen. To expand, like Mississippi has now done, violates the Eighth Amendment.
But the U.S. Supreme Court has yet to rule on this, Noose said.
True, but a case like this could well lead the court to strike down the new law.
I'm not sure I'm in a position to strike it down, Mr. Brigance.
I understand this, Your Honor. But you can certainly see that it is an unfair law, and you have the power to quash the indictment on these grounds. The state will then be required to re-indict on a lesser charge.
Mr. Dyer.
Lowell stood at his table and said, "The law is the law, and it's on the books, Your Honor, plain and simple. The legislature has the power to pass whatever it chooses, and it's our responsibility to follow its dictates. Until the law is amended or struck down by a higher court, we have no choice. You chose the wording of the indictment and the statute you're prosecuting under," Jake said. "No one made you indict for capital murder." "It's capital, Mr. Brigance. Cold-blooded murder." "The term cold-blooded murder appears nowhere in the statute, Mr. Dyer. There's no need to sensationalize it."
"Gentlemen," Noose said loudly, "I've read the briefs on this issue, and I'm not inclined to quash the indictment. It follows the statute whether we agree with it or not. Motion denied."
Jake was not surprised, but to argue this point on appeal after a conviction, he was required to raise it now. He had long since accepted the reality that he would be litigating appeals for Drew for years to come, and much of the groundwork had to be laid before the trial. The statute's validity had not been tested before the U.S. Supreme Court, and it seemed destined to go there. Noose shuffled some papers and said to Jake,
"What's next?"
Portia handed Jake a brief, and he returned to the podium. "Your Honor, we are asking the court to move the defendant to a juvenile facility until the trial. He is now, and has for the past 2.5 months, been locked up here in the county jail, which is no place for a 16-year-old. In a juvenile facility, he will at least be housed with other minors and given limited contact. More importantly, he will have access to some level of educational instruction. He is at least 2 years behind in his schoolwork."
"I thought I had approved a private tutor," Noose said, peering over the reading glasses that were perpetually lodged at the very tip of his long, sloping nose.
"A few hours a week, Your Honor, and that's not enough. I know the tutor very well, and she says he needs daily instruction. He is barely keeping up and will only fall further behind. I've spoken to the director of the facility down in Starkville, and he assures me the defendant will be secured and confined. There is no chance of escape." Noose was frowning. He looked at the district attorney and said,
"Mr. Dyer."
Lowell rose at his table and said, "Your Honor, I've checked with the directors of all 3 juvenile facilities in this state, and there's not a single capital murder defendant in any of them. Our system simply doesn't work that way. For a crime like this, the defendant is always held in the county where the crime took place. Mr. Gamble will be tried as an adult." Jake said, "Adults are finished with their education, Your Honor. The ones in jail may need more of it, but it's behind them. That's not true for this defendant. If he gets sent to Parchment, he'll have access to some level of instruction, though I'm sure it's inadequate." Dyer said, "And he'll be held in maximum security. That's where capital murderers are housed. He hasn't been convicted yet. Why not place him with other juveniles and at least give him the chance to be in a classroom? There's nothing on the books to prevent this. It's true that these defendants are customarily held in their home counties, but that's not the law. The court has discretion."
"It's never been done," Dyer argued. "So why make an exception now?"
"Gentlemen," Noose said again, cutting off the debate, "I'm not inclined to move the defendant. He's charged as an adult and will be tried as one. And he'll be treated as one. Motion overruled." Again, Jake was not surprised. He fully expected Judge Noose to preside over a fair trial and favor neither side, so asking for favors at this point was a waste of time.
"What's next, Mr. Brigance?"
That's all the defense has for now, Your Honor. Mr. Dyer has a motion in limine, and I suggest that we take it up in chambers. Dyer said, Agreed, Your Honor. It's of a sensitive nature and should not be discussed in open court, at least not now. Very well. We will adjourn and reconvene in chambers.
Stepping over to his table, Jake couldn't help but steal a glance at the coffers. If Earl had a gun, he would have opened fire. Noose removed his robe and fell into his throne at the end of the table. Jake, Libby, and Portia sat along one side. Opposite were Lowell Dyer and his assistant, D.R. Musgrove, a veteran prosecutor. The court reporter sat to the side with her stenograph and recorder. Noose fired up his pipe without thinking to open a window. He sucked in a mouthful of smoke as he scanned a brief in front of him. He exhaled and said,
This is very troubling.
It was Dyer's motion, so he spoke first.
Your Honor, we want to limit some of the testimony at trial. Evidently, this killing took place after a nasty fight between Josie Gamble and Stuart Cofer. We will not call her as a witness, but the defense certainly will. Therefore, she will be asked questions about the fight, prior fights, and perhaps other physical abuse by the deceased. This could turn into a real circus as the defense, in effect, puts Stuart Cofer on trial. He will not be around to defend himself. This is simply not fair. The state seeks a ruling by the court pre-trial that testimony about any alleged physical abuse be severely restricted.
Noose was flipping through the motion and supporting brief filed by Dyer, though he had already read it.
Mr. Brigantz.
Libby cleared her throat and said,
Your Honor, may I?
Of course.
The reputation of the deceased is always fair game, especially in situations like this where violence was in play.
She was precise, with perfect diction, her Scottish brogue conveying authority.
In our brief, we trace the history of this issue in this state for many decades. Rarely has testimony about the deceased's violent reputation been excluded, especially when the defendant was also the subject of abuse.
The kid was abused? Noose asked.
Yes, but we did not include this in our brief because it would then be public record. On at least four occasions, Mr. Cofer slapped Drew in the face, in addition to threatening him many times. He lived in fear of the man, as did Josie and Kira.
How extensive was the physical abuse?
Libby quickly slid across the table an 8x10 color photo of Josie in the hospital with her face bandaged. She continued,
Well, we can start with Josie on the night in question. He slapped her in the face, then knocked her out with a broken jaw that required surgery.
Noose gawked at the photo. Dyer frowned at his copy. Libby said,
Josie will testify that the beatings were common and were happening with more frequency. She wanted to leave and was threatening to do so, but had no place to go. The family, Your Honor, was living in a state of well-earned fear. Drew was being slapped around and threatened, and Kira was being sexually abused.
Come on, Dyer hissed.
I didn't expect you to like it, Mr. Dyer, but it's the truth, and it needs to be discussed at trial.
Dyer said angrily,
That's the problem here, Judge, and this is why I filed a motion to compel testimony from the girl. Jake wouldn't allow her to answer my questions. I have the right to know what she'll say at trial.
A motion to compel in a criminal case? Noose asked.
Yes, Judge, it's only fair. We're getting ambushed here.
Jake loved the word ambush. Just wait until you see her belly.
Noose said, But if you call her to the stand, she's your witness. I'm not sure how you can compel the testimony of your own witness.
Dyer replied, I'll be forced to call her.
There were three witnesses at the scene. The mother was unconscious and did not hear the gunshot. It's unlikely the defendant will testify. That leaves the girl. Now I learn that she was sexually abused. This isn't fair, Your Honor. I'm not inclined to grant your motion to compel her to talk now. Fine, then we won't call her to the stand.
Then we will, Jake said. Dyer glared at him, fell back into his chair, and crossed his arms over his chest. Defeated. He stewed for a moment as the tension rose, then said,
This just isn't fair. You cannot allow this trial to descend into a one-sided slander fest against a dead police officer.
Jake said, The facts are the facts, Mr. Dyer. We can't change them.
No, but the court can certainly restrict some of this testimony. That's an excellent idea, Mr. Dyer. I'll take your motion under advisement and rule at trial when I see where things are going. You can renew them at that time, and you can certainly object to any testimony.
It'll be too late, Dyer said.
Damned right it will be, Jake thought to himself.
Carla baked a pan of chicken thighs with cherry tomatoes and morel mushrooms, and they ate on the patio after dark. A thunderstorm had moved through and taken most of the humidity with it. Avoiding all talk of murder and trials of teenage killers, they tried their best to stick to more pleasant matters. Libby told stories of growing up in Scotland, in a small town near Glasgow. Her father was a well-known barrister and had encouraged her to follow the law. Her mother taught literature at a nearby college and wanted her to become a doctor. An American teacher inspired her to study in the States, and she had never left. As a law student at Georgetown, she had sat through a gut-wrenching trial of a 17-year-old boy with a low IQ and a heartbreaking history. He had been given life without parole. A death sentence. Enough of that. Her next story was about her first husband, who was now on everybody's short list to be nominated to the Supreme Court. Dr. Thane Sedgwick had spent 3 hours with Drew in his cell and preferred to talk about something else. They would meet for 2 more hours in the morning, and Sedgwick would prepare a lengthy profile. Sedgwick was quite the raconteur. His father had been a rancher in rural Texas, and he had spent his childhood in a saddle. His great-grandfather had once shot 2 cattle rustlers, loaded their bodies into his wagon, and delivered them to the sheriff 2 hours away. The sheriff thanked him. Late in the evening, Libby said to Sedgwick, I doubt you'll be needed in this trial.
Oh, really? Feeling pretty confident, huh?
No, Jake quipped. We have no grounds for confidence. Libby said, I see a trial that will be difficult for either side to win.
You don't know these jurors, Jake said. In spite of what you heard today, there will be a lot of sympathy for the deceased, and no small amount of resentment for the way he'll be portrayed at trial. We have to be careful.
Carla said, Enough of that. Who wants peach cobbler?
Chapter 30. The following Saturday, Jake and Carla dropped off Hannah in Caraway to spend the day with her grandparents. She saw Jake's parents every week, but it was never enough. After a quick cup of coffee and a brief visit, they left her there, and it was impossible to tell who was more excited, Hannah or Mr. and Mrs. Brigance. They headed to Oxford, a town they would always love because of their college days. They had met at a fraternity party when they were juniors and had been together ever since. One of their favorite day trips was to spend a Saturday at an Ole Miss football game and tailgate with old college friends. Several times a year, they made the hour drive for no reason other than to get out of town, to park on the picturesque square, visit the bookstore, and have a long lunch in one of the many good restaurants before returning to Clanton. In the back seat were the housewarming gifts, a toaster and a platter of Carla's chocolate chip cookies.
She had wanted to bring baby gifts because Kira would have nothing, but Jake said no. As a lawyer, he had witnessed firsthand the damage that could be done once a young mother saw her baby, held it, and immediately got attached to it. They often changed their minds and refused to go forward with the adoption. He knew that Josie would not let that happen. Nonetheless, Jake insisted they do nothing that might arouse the powerful feelings of motherhood. 2 years earlier, he had spent an entire day at the hospital in Clanton, waiting with the paperwork as a 15-year-old mother agonized over her final signature. His clients, a childless couple in their early 40s, sat in his office and stared at the phone. Late in the day, the hospital administrator informed Jake that, with such indecision, she could not sign off. The administrator felt as though the mother was being coerced by her mother, the new grandmother, and any decision was not being freely made. As Jake lingered, he was eventually told that a decision had been made and the child would not be given up for adoption. He drove to his office and broke the news to his clients. The scene was still painful to recall. He and Carla were not yet committed to an addition to their family. They had discussed it for hours and had agreed to keep talking about it. They had a doctor friend in town whose phone rang at 4 o'clock one morning. He and his wife hustled over to Tupelo and returned home at noon with a 3-day-old baby, their second adoption. Their decision had been instant, but then they had been searching for a long time. They knew what they wanted and were committed. Jake and Carla weren't there yet. Before Kira, they had not thought about adopting for many years. The idea was laden with complications. Though Jake claimed not to worry about the town and any appearance of impropriety, he knew that they would be criticized by some for seizing the opportunity to take a baby from a client. To this, Carla pushed back with her belief that any criticism would be temporary and would go away as the years passed and the child prospered in a good home. Besides, wasn't Jake being condemned enough already? Let him talk. Their families and friends would be thrilled for them and would circle the wagons. Who else really mattered? Jake worried about raising a child in a community where his DNA might become known. He would be the product of a rape. His real father had been murdered. His real mother was just a kid herself. Carla pushed back with the argument that the child would never know it. "No one gets to pick their parents," she liked to say. The child would be sheltered and loved as much as any lucky kid, and with time, folks would accept him for what he was. The DNA couldn't be changed. Jake didn't like the fact that the Kofers would always be close by. He doubted they would have any interest in the child, but that was not a certainty. Carla believed they would not. Besides, neither she nor Jake had ever met the Kofers. They lived in another part of the county, and their paths had never crossed. The private adoption would take place in Oxford, in a different judicial district, and in a closed proceeding where the file could be sealed. And there was a good chance that most of the townsfolk, the very people Jake claimed to now care nothing for, would never know the details. Though he avoided discussing it, Jake was concerned about the expense. Hannah was 9, and they had not yet started saving for her college. Indeed, their meager savings had just been raided, and their financial future looked grim. Adding a child would require Carla to stay at home for at least the next year or two, and they needed her salary. The gambles could damn well bankrupt him. Notwithstanding Noose's rather screwball scheme to get him compensated for the trial, he expected to be paid very little. The first loan to Josie was for $800 and a new transmission. The second was $600 to cover the deposit on the apartment, the first month's rent, and hooking up the utilities. The landlord wanted a six-month lease, which Jake signed in his name. Same for the phone, gas, and electricity. Nothing was in Josie's name, and he advised her to find a job as a waitress and work for cash and tips. The bill collectors would have trouble finding her. There was nothing illegal about this arrangement, but he didn't feel entirely comfortable with it. Under the circumstances, though, he had no choice. When Josie left Ford County 2 weeks earlier, she was working three part-time jobs and had proven adept at hustling for low wages. She promised to repay every dime, but Jake had his doubts. Her rent was $300 a month, and she was determined to pay at least half of it. The next loan would be to cover Kira's medical care. She was almost 7 months along, and so far, there had been no complications. Jake had no idea what it would cost. On a troubling note, Josie had mentioned on the phone the issue of money for the adoption. Jake had explained that the adopting parents always cover the costs of the delivery and the lawyer's fees. Josie would be expected to pay nothing. She then beat around the bush for a few minutes and asked, "Is there anything in the deal for the mother?" In other words, exchanging money for the baby. Jake had anticipated this and quickly replied, "No, that's not permissible." Although it was, he had handled an adoption years earlier in which the prospective parents agreed to pay an additional $5,000 to the young mother, which was not unheard of in private adoptions. Agencies charged a fee, and some of the money was quietly routed to the mother. However, the last thing he wanted was for Josie to get wild ideas and dream of making a profit. He had assured her that he and Pastor McGarry would find a nice home for the baby. No need for her to go shopping around. They parked on the square and did a loop, checking the windows of the shops they had known in college. They browsed through square books and had coffee upstairs on the porch while gazing at the courthouse lawn where Mr. Faulkner once sat alone and watched the town. At noon, they went to a deli and bought sandwiches for lunch. The apartment building was a few blocks off the square, on a side street, crammed with cheap student housing. Jake had lived nearby for 3 years during law school. Josie answered the door with a huge smile, obviously delighted to see someone she knew. She invited them in and proudly showed off her new coffee machine, one given to her by the ladies of Good Shepherd. When Charles McGarry informed them that Josie and Kira would be moving away and into their own apartment, the entire church gathered a collection of used bedsheets, towels, dishes, more clothing, and a few small appliances. The apartment was furnished with the bare basics, sofas, chairs, beds, and tables that had been abused by long-forgotten college students. As they sat at the kitchen table and had coffee, Kira appeared and gave them hugs. In a t-shirt and shorts, her pregnancy was becoming obvious, though Carla later said she was showing little to be that far along. She said she felt fine, was bored with no television, but was reading a lot of paperbacks donated by the church. Not surprisingly, Josie had already landed a job waiting tables at a diner north of town, 20 hours a week, cash and tips. Carla had spent 4 hours with Drew that week and gave a glowing account of his progress. After a slow start, he was showing an interest in science and Mississippi history, though he had no use for math. Talk of him saddened Josie, and her eyes watered. She planned to drive to the jail on Sunday for a long visit. All four agreed that they were hungry. Kira changed into jeans and put on sandals, and they drove to the Ole Miss campus, which on a Saturday in June was deserted. They parked near the grove, the shaded, park-like expanse that was the heart of the school. They found a picnic table under an ancient oak, and Carla unpacked sandwiches, chips, and soft drinks. As they ate, Jake pointed to the law school over there, the student union not far away, and described the Grove on game day, when it was packed with tens of thousands of tailgaters. And over there, under that tree, near the stage, was where he surprised his girlfriend with an engagement ring and asked her to marry him. Luckily, she said yes. Kira loved the story and wanted all the details. It was obvious that she was enthralled with the idea of such a future, of going to college, of having some handsome boy propose to her, of having a life far different from what she had known. She got prettier each time Carla saw her. The unwanted pregnancy agreed with her, at least on the surface. Carla wondered if she had ever set foot on a college campus before. She adored Kira, and her heart ached at what the girl was facing. The fear of giving birth, of letting go of her child, the stigma of being raped and pregnant at 14. She needed counseling, and plenty of it, but it wasn't happening. The best scenario was that she would give birth in late September, then enroll as a freshman at Oxford High School, as if nothing had happened. A law school buddy of Jake's was the city attorney and would facilitate matters. After lunch, they took a long walk through the campus. Jake and Carla alternated as tour guides. They passed the football stadium, the Lyceum, the chapel, and they bought ice cream in the student union. On a sidewalk along Sorority Row, Carla pointed out the Phi Mu house where she had lived as a sophomore and junior. Kira whispered to her, "What's a sorority?" Several times during the languid walk, Carla wondered what would happen if they adopted the baby. Would they be forced to forget about Kira and Josie? Jake felt strongly that they would. He believed the safest adoptions were those where all contact with the real mother was cut off. At the same time, though, he feared that the Gambles would be a part of their lives for years to come. If Drew got convicted, Jake would be tied up with appeals forever. A hung jury, and there would be another trial, then perhaps another. Only an acquittal would rid them of the family, and that was highly unlikely. It was all so complicated and unpredictable. On Sunday morning, the Brigance family dressed in their finest and left for church. At the edge of town, Hannah asked from the back seat,
"Hey, where are we going?"
Jake said, "We're visiting another church today."
"Why?"
"Because you always say that the sermons are boring. Half the time you fall asleep. There are at least 1,000 churches around here, and we thought we'd try another one."
"But I didn't say I wanted to go somewhere else. What about my friends in Sunday school?"
"Oh, you'll see them again," Carla said.
"Where's your sense of adventure? Going to church is an adventure?"
"Just hang on. I think you'll like this place."
"Where is it?"
"You'll see." Hannah said nothing more and sulked as they drove through the countryside. When they parked in the gravel lot next to Good Shepherd, she said,
"This is it? It's so small."
"It's a country church," Carla said. "They're always smaller."
"I don't think I like it."
Jake said, "If you'll be sweet, we'll take you to lunch at Nana's."
"Lunch at Nana's? All right."
Jake's mother had called that morning with the invitation they were always anticipating. She had picked fresh corn and tomatoes from her garden and was in the mood to cook. Some men were finishing their cigarettes under a shade tree to one side. Some women were chatting at the front door. The Braganzas were met in the vestibule by an usher, a woman who greeted them warmly and gave each a bulletin for the service. Inside the handsome sanctuary, the pianist was playing as they found a seat in a padded pew halfway to the front. Charles McGarry quickly spotted them and walked over with a warm hello. Meg was at home with the baby, who had a cold but was otherwise doing fine. He thanked them for coming and was genuinely happy to see them. As city folks, they immediately felt overdressed, but no one seemed to care. Jake noticed only one other dark suit among the pews. He couldn't help but notice the stairs. Word was out. Mr. Brigance was in the house, and others began stopping by for friendly welcomes. At 11, a small choir in blue robes filed in from a side door, and Pastor McGarry stepped to the pulpit for his opening announcements. He offered a short prayer, then yielded to the choir director, who asked them to stand. After three stanzas, they sat and listened to a solo. When the sermon began, Hannah moved to a cozier spot between her parents and seemed ready for a nap, determined to prove she could sleep through any service. For a preacher so young and without a lot of training, Charles was at home in the pulpit. His sermon came from Paul's letter to Philemon, and his theme was forgiveness. Our ability to forgive others, even those who are undeserving, is indicative of the forgiveness we received from God through Christ. Jake enjoyed sermons and all other types of speeches. He invariably timed them. Lucian had taught him that anything beyond 20 minutes, especially final summations to juries, and you risked losing your audience. In Jake's first jury trial, an armed robbery, his closing argument lasted all of 11 minutes, and it had worked. His minister at the Presbyterian Church, like most preachers, tended to run long, and Jake had suffered through too many sermons that ran out of gas and became boring. Charles was finished in 18 minutes and closed nicely. When he sat down, a children's choir lit up the place with a lively song. Hannah perked up and enjoyed the music. Then Charles was back as he asked the worshipers to share their joys and concerns. It was definitely a different type of service, far less stuffy, much warmer, and with a lot more humor. After the benediction, Jake and Carla were surrounded by the members who wanted to make sure they felt sufficiently welcomed. Chapter 31. In what felt like a never-ending string of bad days, Monday promised to be one of the worst. Unable to concentrate, Jake watched the clock until 9:55, then left his office for a quick stroll to the other side of the square. There were three banks in Clanton. Stan at security had already said no. The Sullivans ran not only the largest law firm in the county, but some cousins held a majority interest in the biggest bank. Jake would not subject himself to the indignity of asking them for money. They would say no anyway, and gleefully. He walked past their law firm and cursed them, then cursed them again as he walked past their bank. The third, People's Trust, was run by Herb Cutler, a chubby old curmudgeon Jake had always avoided. He wasn't a bad guy, just a tight-fisted banker who demanded more than enough collateral for any loan. The nerve! To get money from Herb, one had to show enough collateral to prove that one didn't really need a loan to begin with. Jake entered the lobby as if someone was holding a gun to his head. The receptionist pointed to a corner, and he entered a huge, messy office at exactly 10 o'clock. Herb, in his standard bright red suspenders, was waiting behind his desk and did not stand up. They shook hands and went through the usual preliminaries, though Herb didn't waste many words and was known for his bluntness. He was already shaking his head as he got down to business.
"Jake, I just don't know about the loan. This idea of refinancing your mortgage, this appraisal seems awfully high. I mean, $300,000? I know you paid $250,000 for the place 2 years ago, but it looks to me like Willie Traynor clipped you on it."
No, Herb. I got a good deal. Plus, my wife really wanted the place. I can handle a new mortgage.
Really? $300,000 for 30 years at 10%? That's a monthly nut of $2,500.
I know that, and it's no problem.
The house ain't worth it, Jake. You're in Clanton, not North Jackson.
He knew that, too.
Plus taxes and insurance, and you're looking at $3,000. I mean, hell, Jake, that's a big mortgage for anybody in this town.
Herb, I know that, and I can swing it. Such a number made him nauseous, and he suspected he wasn't faking it very well. For the month of May, his quiet little office had grossed less than $2,000. June was on track to see even less.
Well, I need to see some proof. Financials, tax returns, the like. Not sure I can trust them because I damn sure don't trust your appraisal. What's your gross going to be this year?
The indignity was overwhelming. Suffering at the whim of another banker who wanted to poke through his books. You know how it is, Herb, in this business. You can't predict what'll walk in the door. I'll probably do 150. Half of that would be a bonanza at the current rate.
Well, I don't know. Put together some financials and I'll take a look. What's in the pipeline now?
What do you mean?
Look, Jake, I deal with lawyers all the time. What's the best case in your office?
The Smallwood wrongful deaths against the railroad.
Oh, really? I heard that one blew up in your face.
Not at all. Judge Noose will give us a new trial date later in the fall. We're on track, so to speak.
Ha ha! What's the next best case?
There wasn't one. Jesse Turnipseed's mother slipped on some pickle juice on the floor at the grocery store and broke her arm. It healed perfectly. The insurance company was offering $7,000. Jake couldn't threaten with a trial because she had a habit of falling in well-insured stores when no one was around. The usual assortment of car wrecks and such, he said with a discernible lack of conviction.
Junk? Anything of value?
Not really. Not now, anyway.
What about other assets? I mean, anything worth a shit?
Oh, how he hated bankers. His paltry savings account had been demolished to pay Stan. Some savings, couple of cars, you know.
I know. What about other debts? You and Hawk up to your ears like most lawyers around here?
Credit cards, the monthly note on Carla's vehicle. He wouldn't dare mention the litigation loan because Herb would blow a gasket. The very idea of borrowing that much money to fund a lawsuit. At that moment, it did indeed seem foolish. The usual, nothing serious, nothing I'm not taking care of.
Look, let's cut to the chase here, Jake. Get some numbers together, and I'll take a look. But I gotta tell you, 300 won't work. Hell, I'm not sure 250 ain't too much.
Will do. Thanks, Herb. See you around.
Don't mention it.
Jake bolted from the office. His hatred of banks refortified. He left thoroughly defeated and slinked back to his office. The next meeting would be even more painful. 3 hours later, Harry Rex stomped up his stairs, cracked the door, and said,
"Let's go."
They made the same walk Jake had made earlier in the day, but stopped at the Sullivan Law Firm. A pretty secretary led them to a large, majestic conference room with people waiting. On one side of the table, Walter Sullivan sat with Sean Gilder and one of his many associates. The two railroad lawyers were with them. The handshaking took a while, and everybody was polite. A court reporter sat at one end, next to the chair reserved for the witness. On cue, Mr. Neil Nickel walked in and said hello. The court reporter swore him to tell the truth, and he took his seat. It was Gilder's deposition, and he quickly took charge with instructions for the witness and a long list of preliminary questions. Since he worked by the hour, he was slow and meticulous. Jake studied Nichols' face and felt as though he knew him well. He had seen him so many times in the photos at the accident scene. He was still wearing a dark suit and was articulate, educated, and not the least bit intimidated. The ugly truth came out soon enough. On the night of the crash, he was following an old pickup truck that was barely staying on the road, swerving from one shoulder to the other. Nickel gave it plenty of room. As he topped a hill, he saw the red crossing lights flashing at the bottom. A train was passing. The headlights from the pickup and the car in front of it reflected off the bright yellow warning strips attached to each boxcar. Suddenly, there was an explosion. The pickup hit the brakes, as did Nickel. He got out and raced to the crossing and saw the small car had flipped 180 degrees and was facing him. Its front crumpled into an ugly mess. The train was still passing, clicking along at a reasonable speed, as if nothing had happened. The driver of the truck, a Mr. Grayson, was yelling and flailing his arms as he ran around the car. Inside, there was a mess. The driver, a man, and his woman passenger were crushed, mangled, bleeding. A little boy and little girl were crushed in the rear seat and apparently dead. Nickel walked to some weeds and vomited as the train finally cleared. Another car stopped, then another, and as they crowded around the wreck, they realized they could do nothing. The train stopped and began to slowly come back in reverse.
"They're dead! They're all dead!" Grayson kept saying as he circled the wreck.
The other drivers were as horrified as Nickel. Then there were sirens, and plenty of them. The responders quickly realized there was no urgency. All four were dead. Nickel wanted to leave, but the highway was blocked. He wasn't from the area and didn't know the back roads, so he waited and watched with the crowd. For 3 hours, he stood off to the side and watched as the firemen cut and sawed and removed the bodies. It was a horrible scene, one he would never forget. He had had nightmares. With this beautiful gift in hand, Sean Gilder slowly and meticulously walked Nickel through his testimony again, nailing down every detail. He handed him large photos of the crossing lights, but Nickel said he didn't think to observe them in the chaos. They were flashing away at the time of the collision, and that was all that mattered. Sadly, at least for the plaintiffs, Nickel was far more credible than Hank Grayson, who still maintained that the lights were not flashing, and he himself didn't see the train until he almost crashed into the small wood vehicle. Having far too much fun, Gilder then moved to events that took place months after the accident. In particular, the meeting with a private investigator at Nickel's office in Nashville. Nickel had been surprised that someone had found him. The investigator said he was working for a lawyer in Clanton, but did not give his name. Nickel cooperated fully and told the investigator the same story he had just testified to under oath, leaving out no details. The investigator thanked him and went away, never to be heard from again. Back in February, he had been traveling near Clanton and decided to stop by the courthouse. He asked about the lawsuit and was told that the file was a public record. He spent 2 hours with it and realized that Hank Grayson was sticking to his original story. Nickel was bothered by this, but still did not want to get involved because he had sympathy for the Smallwoods. However, over time, he felt compelled to come forward. In the deposition game, some lawyers played all their cards and flushed out every detail. Their goal was to win the deposition. Gilder was in that camp. Better lawyers held back and didn't reveal their strategies. They saved their best shots for trial. Great lawyers often skipped the depositions altogether and plotted brutal cross-examinations. Jake had no questions for the witness. He could have asked Nickel why, as an eyewitness, he said nothing to the police. The scene was crawling with deputies, and there were 2 state troopers working the crowd, but Nickel had offered nothing. He stood silently by and kept his mouth shut. His name appeared in none of the reports. Jake could have asked him a question that was so obvious, yet had so far been missed by Gilder and his team. The train cleared the crossing, stopped, and backed up because the engineer had heard a thud. On the track, trains ran both ways. Why, then, did the lights not work when the train approached from the other direction, in reverse? Jake had statements from a dozen witnesses who swore the lights were not flashing while the train sat nearby and the rescue was underway. Gilder, either overconfident or just lazy, had not spoken to these witnesses. Jake could have asked him about his past. Nickel was 47 years old. At the age of 22, he had been involved in a terrible auto accident in which three teenagers were killed. They were drinking beer, joyriding, racing down a country road on a Friday night when they ran head-on into a car driven by Nickel. As it turned out, everybody was drunk. Nickel registered .10 and was arrested for drunk driving. There was talk of an indictment for manslaughter, but the authorities eventually decided the accident was not his fault. The three families sued anyway, and the case dragged on for 4 years before his insurance company negotiated a nuisance settlement. Thus, his reluctance to get involved. This valuable background had been discovered by a private investigator who charged Jake $3,500, another ding to the old tort sport loan sitting in Stan's office. Jake had the dirt. Sean Gilder probably did not, because he didn't mention it during the deposition. Jake relished the moment when he sprung it on Nickel before the jury and slaughtered him with it. His credibility would be tarnished, but his past would not change the facts of the Smallwood accident. Jake and Harry Rex had argued over strategy. Harry Rex wanted a full frontal assault in the deposition to spook the defense and soften up Gilder for, just maybe, some settlement talk. They were desperate for cash, but Jake still dreamed of a big verdict in his courtroom, and he would not push for a trial. A year needed to pass for things to settle down. The gamble trial needed to come and go and take the baggage with it. Harry Rex thought this was a foolish dream. Hanging on for a year seemed impossible. Chapter 32. Jake worked late on Monday and left the office after dark. Preoccupied, he was almost home when he remembered Carla wanted milk, eggs, 2 cans of tomato sauce, and coffee from the grocery store. He turned around and went to a Kroger east of town. He parked his red Saab in the lot that was almost empty, went in, filled his basket, checked out, sacked his own items, and was almost to his car when things took a sudden turn for the worse. An unfriendly voice behind him said, "Hey, Brigantz!" Jake turned and for a split second saw a face that was vaguely familiar. Holding the grocery bag, he couldn't duck in time to miss the sucker punch. It landed flush on his nose, cracked it, and knocked him to the asphalt beside his car. For a second, he could see nothing. A heavy boot landed on his right ear as he scrambled around. He felt a can of tomato sauce and quickly hurled it at the man, hitting him in the face. The man yelled, "You son of a bitch!" and kicked him again. Jake was almost to his feet when a second man tackled him from behind. He landed hard on the asphalt again and managed to grab the hair of his tackler. The same heavy boot landed again on his forehead, and Jake was too stunned to fight back. He released his grip on the hair and tried to get up, but he was pinned on his back. The second assailant, a thick, heavy guy, pounded away at his face, cursing and growling, while the first one kicked his ribs and gut and anywhere else he could land a boot. When he kicked him in the testicles, Jake screamed and blacked out. Two loud gunshots cracked through the air, and someone yelled, "Stop it!" The two thugs were startled and bolted from the scene. They were last seen sprinting around the corner of the store. Mr. William Bradley ran over with his pistol and said, "Oh my God!" Jake was unconscious, and his face was a bloody mess. When Carla arrived at the ER, Jake was being x-rayed. A nurse told her, "He's breathing on his own and somewhat alert. That's all I know right now." His parents arrived half an hour later, and she met them in the waiting room. Mr. William Bradley was in a corner talking to a Clanton City policeman, giving his story. A doctor, Maze McKee, a friend from church, stopped by for the second time and gave them the latest.
"It's a pretty nasty beating," he said gravely. "But Jake is awake and stable and in no danger. Some cuts and bruises, a broken nose. We're still doing x-rays and giving him morphine. A lot of pain. I'll be back in a minute."
He eased away, and Carla sat with Jake's parents. A county deputy, Parnell Johnson, arrived and spent a moment with them. He huddled with Mr. Bradley and the city policeman, then sat on a coffee table in front of Carla and said,
"Looks like there were two of them. They jumped Jake as he was about to get into his car outside Kroger. Mr. Bradley over there had just parked and saw the beating and grabbed his .38. He fired twice, ran him off. He saw a green GMC pickup race away on a side street behind the store. No idea of who it was. Not now, anyway."
"Thank you," Carla said. A long hour passed before Dr. McKee returned. He told them Jake had been moved to a private room and wanted to see Carla. His parents would not be allowed in at the moment, but could visit tomorrow. Dr. McKee and Carla went to the third floor and stopped outside a closed door. The doctor whispered,
"He looks terrible, and he's pretty groggy. Broken nose, two broken ribs, two missing teeth, three cuts on his face that required 41 stitches. But I got Dr. Pendergrass to sew him up. He's the best, and he doesn't expect significant scarring."
She took a deep breath and closed her eyes. At least he was alive.
"Can I stay here tonight?"
"Sure. They'll send in a fold-away bed."
He pushed the door open, and they eased inside. Carla almost fainted when she saw her husband. From his eyebrows up, everything was wrapped in heavy gauze. Another bandage covered most of his chin. A line of small black stitches ran across his nose. His eyes were hideous, swollen shut with bulging masses as large as boiled eggs. His lips were thick, puffy, and red. A tube snaked its way into his mouth, while two IVs hung from above. She swallowed hard and took his hand.
"Jake, honey, I'm here."
She kissed him softly on the cheek, on a small patch of open skin. He grunted and tried to smile.
"Hey, babe, you okay?"
She had to smile too, although he could see nothing.
"Let's not worry about me right now. I'm here, and you're going to be okay."
He mumbled something incomprehensible, then moved a leg and groaned. Dr. McKee said,
"He took a nasty shot to the crotch, and his testicles are quite swollen, and the swelling will continue."
Jake heard them and said, with remarkable clarity,
"Hey, babe, you want to fool around?"
"No, I don't. We'll have to wait a couple of days."
"Damn it!"
A long moment passed as she squeezed his hand and stared at his bandages. The tears began and were soon running down her cheeks. Jake appeared to doze off, and Dr. McKee nodded at the door. In the hallway, he said,
"He has a concussion I want to monitor, so he'll be here for a couple of days. I don't think it's serious, but we need to watch it. Stay if you like, but there's really no need. There's nothing you can do, and I think he'll soon drift off and go to sleep."
"I'm staying. His parents will keep Hannah."
As you wish. I'm really sorry about this, Carla. Thank you, Dr. McKee. He's going to be okay. Really sore for the next week or so, but he's in one piece. Thank you.
Harry Rex showed up and cursed a nurse when she turned him away. On the way out the door, he threatened to sue her. By midnight, Jake had not made a sound in over an hour. Carla, barefoot and still in jeans, sat propped up on pillows in her flimsy foldaway and flipped through magazines under a dim table lamp. She tried not to think about who the thugs were, but she knew the beating was related to Kofor. 5 years earlier, the Klan had burned their home and taken a shot at Jake outside the courthouse during the Haley affair. For 3 years, they had lived with guns and extra security because the threats continued. She could not believe the violence was back. What kind of life were they living? No other lawyer faced such intimidation. Why them? Why did her husband get involved with dangerous cases that paid nothing? For 12 years, they had worked hard and tried to save and dreamed of building something for the future. Jake had an enormous capacity for work and was determined to succeed as a noted trial lawyer. He was ambitious to a fault and dreamed of wowing juries and winning big verdicts. The money would come by the truckload one day. He was certain of it. And look at them now. Her husband beaten to a pulp. His law practice drying up, their debts mounting by the week. At the beach last month, her father had once again, quietly, and when Jake wasn't around, mentioned that he could find a place for Jake in money management. He had several friends who were investors, most of them semi-retired. But they were contemplating putting together a fund to invest in hospitals and medical device startups. She wasn't sure what that meant, and she had not said a word to Jake about it. But it meant a move to the Wilmington area and a complete change of his career. Her father even mentioned a loan to make things easier. If he only knew how deep their debts were. Things would certainly be safer at the beach. At times they had talked about the drudgery of small-town living. The same routines, same friends, the lack of a meaningful social life. For arts and athletics, they had to drive an hour to either Tupelo or Oxford. She enjoyed her friends, but there was the constant game of who had the bigger house, the nicer cars, the sexier vacations. In a small town, everyone was eager to help. But then everyone also knew your business. 2 years ago, they had paid too much for the Hocut house, and she had noticed a definite coolness from a couple of her girlfriends. It was as if the Braganzas were moving up too quickly and leaving the others behind. If they only knew. The nurses came and went, making sleep impossible. The monitors glowed and blinked. The opioids seemed to be working fine. Could this be the pivotal moment in their lives? The final straw that freed Jake from the grind of a ham and eggs lawyer struggling to pay the bills each month? They were not yet 40. There was plenty of time, and it was the perfect moment to change course and move on to something better, to get out of Mississippi and find an easier place. She could always get a job as a schoolteacher. She put down the magazines and closed her eyes. Why not get through the gamble mess in August, adopt Kira's baby in September, and leave Clanton? Drew's future, as uncertain as it was, would be dumped on another lawyer, but there were always plenty of them. Wouldn't it be safer and wiser to move 1,000 miles away? They would be near her parents, who would be eager to help with the babysitting. Jake could start a new career, one that included a guaranteed paycheck each month, and they would live at the beach year-round. She was wide-eyed when a nurse eased in at 1:30 and gave her a sleeping pill. For breakfast, Jake sipped apple juice from a carton through a straw. His entire body ached, and he complained of pain everywhere. A nurse cranked up the morphine, and he slipped away. At 7, Dr. McKee appeared and told Carla that he wanted to do a brain scan and more x-rays. He suggested that she leave for a few hours, check on the house and Hannah, and take care of herself. At home, she called Jake's parents with an update and asked them to bring Hannah home. She called Harry Rex and told him what little she knew. No, she had not asked Jake if he knew who beat him. She called Portia, Lucian, Stan at Cabbage, and Judge Noose, all of whom had questions, but she kept the conversations brief. She would call again later. She fed the dog, cleaned the kitchen, washed a load of clothes, and sat on the patio with a cup of coffee and tried to collect herself. One concern was what to tell Hannah. They couldn't hide Jake from his daughter, and he would look awful for days to come. The child would be horrified when she saw her father, and there was no way she could begin to understand. She would be terrified to learn that there were bad people out there who wanted to hurt her dad. The coffee didn't help her nerves, and she finally called her mother and told her what was going on. At 11, Mr. and Mrs. Brigance arrived with Hannah, who ran to her mother in tears and asked her how Daddy was doing. Carla hugged her, said he was at the hospital but doing fine, and that she would spend the day at Becky's house. She needed to get a quick bath and change clothes. She reluctantly left the kitchen, and Carla asked Mrs. Brigance, "What did you tell her?"
"Not much, just that her dad had been injured, was at the hospital, but would be home soon, and everything was okay."
Mr. Brigance said, "We weren't sure what to say, but she knows something is up." Carla said, "She can't see him for a few days. It would be too much of a shock."
"When can we see him?" Mrs. Brigance asked. "Today. We'll go in a minute."
The waiting room was getting crowded. When they arrived, they met Portia, Harry Rex, Stan and his wife, and their minister, Dr. Eli Proctor. Carla hugged them all and said she would see Jake and report back. Dr. McKee appeared and motioned for her to join him. They went to Jake's room and found him sitting up and arguing with a nurse who wanted to treat his face with cold packs. Carla spoke to him, took his hand, and he said, "Let's get out of here." Dr. McKee said, "Not so fast, Jake. The scans and x-rays look good, but you're not going anywhere for a few days."
"Days? Are you kidding me?"
He moved a leg and flinched sharply in pain.
"Does it hurt?"
Carla asked.
"Only when I breathe."
"Where's the pain?"
"Pick a spot. My nuts feel like grapefruits." "Don't be crude, Jake. Your mother will be here in a minute."
"Oh, come on. Keep them away for now, okay?"
"I can't even see them. I can't see anything."
Carla smiled and looked at Dr. McKee.
"I think he's doing better already."
"He'll be fine. The concussion is mild. Everything else will mend, but it will take some time."
"So no additional brain damage?" she asked.
"None whatsoever."
"Thanks, dear," Jake said. "Where's Hannah?"
"At the Palmer's, playing with Becky."
"Good. Keep her there. I don't want her spooked by a zombie."
"I'll get your parents, okay?
I don't want to see anybody."
"Relax, Jake. They're worried sick, and they'll just stay a minute or so."
"Whatever."
Carla and Dr. McKee left the room as the nurse eased forward with the cold packs.
"Let's try this again," she said sweetly.
"Touch me, and I'll sue you."
Late in the afternoon, Jake was napping when Dr. McKee gently shook his arm and said, "Jake, you have some visitors." He tried to sit up, flinched again, and mumbled,
"I'm tired of visitors."
"It's Sheriff Walls. I'll step outside." He left them and closed the door. Ozzie and Moss Jr. stepped to his bedside and tried to ignore the shock of his face. Ozzie said,
Hello, Jake.
Jake grunted and said, Ozzy, what brings you here?
Hello, Jake,
Moss Jr. said.
Howdy. I can't see anything, but I'm sure you guys look as stupid as always.
Ozzy said,
Well, probably so. But we won't comment on your looks right now.
Pretty good ass-kicking, wouldn't you say?
One of the best I've seen in a long time,
Ozzy said with a laugh.
So the obvious question is, who did it? Did you get a look?
There were at least two of them. I never saw the second guy. But the first was one of the Kofor boys, either Cecil or Barry. I'm not sure which one because I don't know them. Just saw them in court last week.
Ozzy glanced at Moss Jr., who was nodding. No surprise.
And you're sure? Ozzy asked.
Why would I lie?
Okay, we'll pay him a visit.
Sooner rather than later. I nailed the Kofor guy in the face with a 14-ounce can of tomato sauce. Square in the face. Probably left a mark, but it'll heal in a few days.
Attaboy.
They jumped me, Ozzy. I didn't have much of a chance.
Of course you didn't.
They would have killed me if somebody hadn't started shooting.
Mr. William Bradley pulled up, saw it, and whipped out his pistol.
Jake shook his head as a moment passed. He saved my life. Tell him I'll say thanks when I can.
I'll do that.
And ask him why he didn't take a few shots at them.
We'll go see the Kofors.
Chapter 33. As uncomfortable as they were, the cold packs were working, and Jake eventually stopped complaining about them. By Wednesday morning, the swelling had gone down enough so that he could open his eyes and see blurred images. The first was the pretty face of his wife, who, though unclear, looked better than ever. Jake kissed her for the first time in forever and said,
I'm going home.
Oh, no, you're not. You have appointments this morning. First the eye doctor, then a dentist, then some more doctors, then a rehab specialist.
I'm more concerned about my testicles.
So am I. But there's little to do but ride it out. I took a peek last night when you were snoring, and they're quite impressive. Dr. McKee says there's nothing to do down there but take pain pills and pray that you'll one day walk like a man again.
Which specialist works on testicles?
That would be the urologist. He stopped by when you were out of it and took some pictures.
You're lying.
No, I'm not. I held the sheet up and he clicked away.
Why does he need photos?
Said he likes to enlarge them and hang them on the wall of his reception room.
Jake managed a laugh, one that was cut short when a surge like a hot knife ripped through his ribs and he grimaced. The pain would be a way of life for days, and he was determined not to show it, at least not in front of his wife.
How's Hannah?
She's fine. She's with your parents, and they're having a big time.
That's nice. What have you told her?
Well, not the whole truth. I told her you were involved in an accident, didn't say what type, and that you were injured and need to spend a few days in the hospital. She's very upset and wants to see you.
Not in here. I want to see her too, but I don't want to scare her to death. I'll be home tomorrow and we'll have a little family meeting.
Who said you're going home tomorrow?
I did. I've had enough of this place. The bones are set and cuts are closed. I can convalesce at home with you as my full-time nurse.
Can't wait. Look, Jake, there are a lot of people who are worried about you. Lucian wants to come by, but I told him to wait. Harry Rex calls all the time.
I've seen Harry Rex, and all he did was laugh at me for getting my ass kicked. Lucian can wait. I've talked to Portia, and she's stalling our clients. I think we have maybe three left.
Judge Noose has called.
He should. He got me into this mess.
He's very concerned. Dale called, Judge Attlee, Dr. Proctor, Pastor McGarry, a lot of folks.
They can wait.
I'm in no mood to see anyone if I can avoid them. Let's get home and lock the doors and let me get on my feet. Some folks are just nosy, you know? And some are very concerned. I'm alive, Carla. I'll mend quickly enough. I don't need anyone stopping by to hold my hand. Cecil Kofor was the foreman of a dirt crew working on a channel near the lake. Late in the morning, Moss Jr. and Mick Swayze parked next to his truck and walked into the construction trailer. Cecil was standing and talking on the phone, his hard hat on his desk. Nearby, a secretary looked up, said,